on now? All right. Good evening. This is the November meeting of the San Luis Obispo Health Commission, San Luis Obispo County Health Commission. The first order of business is the approval of the minutes from October 16th. Prior to approving these minutes, I want to make some comments, and then we can decide how we want to deal with this. We have minutes that were typed up and that you received in the mail and also on email. And then, well, there's two instances here. There were some minutes in April at which a member of the public stated that they felt that the one of the quotes was incorrect and wanted to change that. And so the proposed change was submitted. And that you received, I believe, in the, as part of your packet. And then for tonight's minutes, Mr. Phillips wanted to correct or wanted to add to what he said in his public comment at our last meeting. The problem that this brings up is one that we talked about once a couple of years ago about how much detail we have in the minutes. And we had agreed at that time that we like to have detail because that helped us refresh our memories as to what went on at the meeting, because we'd had a sample of the minutes that were more like the Board of Supervisor minutes that were provide the substance. However, now, and that seemed like a good idea at the time. So now the problem that we're having is that if anybody from the public wants to change the minutes or add to them, or they don't like how we've abbreviated them, then we could run into this constantly. And I wasn't aware of this until we got here tonight, but the April thing seemed like maybe that, you know, really did need to be corrected because it was probably misstated. So what I want to do is ask what you all would like to do. My thought is that we probably should confine the public comment in the minutes to a general overview of the subject covered, and then if the person who makes the comments wants to submit to be included with the minutes a full text of their comment, that should be okay, I would think. So then if anybody wanted to know the full text of their comment, they could read it. So what is your pleasure? Commissioner Hetherington.
Given the fact that we had discussed a bit about the SB 1056 at length, I would like to see this spelled out. I mean, there was, I think, a problem with the comment that was made at the end of the Health Commission meeting that, from what you had told me, that you were under the impression that Slow GE Free was a paid lobbying group, when in fact they're not. They weren't. And, you know, to have that be on television and no corrective action taken other than my asking for it to be included in the minutes subsequently, I think is a sticky wicket we don't want to get into. So I think that if Mark made these comments, and I think we have a tape that supports it, then I think those corrections should be reflected.
Well, but then we need to type verbatim probably every word that's said. I have avoided having this discussion about the comment that I made, but I'll make a comment about it now. And the comment is that during Measure Q, Slow GE Free received funds to promote the passage of Measure Q. The fact that maybe nobody was paid that worked for Slow GE Free, I understand, I was told that they are now out of funds, but it didn't change the fact that they were an organization that was formed with the intent to limit or totally eliminate GE products or GE farming in San Luis Obispo County. I don't have a problem with the fact that that's their charter. That's what they do. And my comment was simply to say that when they present a paper, it is from that point of view. And the GMO Task Force presented a paper that reported more than that point of view. And that was the intention. It was not to be a one-sided thing. So therein lies the substance of my remark. Our discussion about it, you can't change history, and the minutes reflect history. So Mr. Phillips addressed how he felt about that remark, which was fine during public comment. That was okay for him to do. That's recorded, you know, that can be recorded in the minutes, but he's actually commented on that in several venues several times. So there we are. And there's nothing further to say about that subject. Yes, you can have an opportunity to speak on this, Mr. Phillips, when we finally figure out what we're doing here. Thank you.
I guess I'll counter with the fact that we don't have people coming in adding or embellishing our comments during the Health Commission unless, you know, they feel that there's been an error. I think every time Eric Greening comes and brings to our attention something that happened at one of the meetings, you know, we take that into consideration. If you don't want to go back and correct the minutes, then I would suggest that we do an addendum to the minutes to make sure that these are included.
Dr. Thomas.
The comment was made whether or not we could do minutes that exactly quoted everybody, and we are not able to do that. That is not within staff capacity to do that. We did that early on, almost did that early on, and it really took somebody 25, 30 hours of staff time to do everything, and we're not capable of doing that. So we do summarize statements, and whenever we are given a copy of the statements that were read by the individual, we do make that part of the official record of the meeting. So I'm talking about the future, not the exact current issue, but staff will continue to summarize statements to the best of our ability, and then it's up to the commission to, if they disagree with it, to make corrections.
Okay, so I'm sorry, Commissioner Dolly.
I was just going to say, I think that just kind of what Dr. Thomas was saying sounds good to me, that we just continue to do what we have been doing, summarizing, having them summarize what's said, and then taking it on a case-by-case basis. Like in this situation, if we have a contested, you know, whether it's an issue or a person from the public really wants to get certain information in, it doesn't seem like we have too often that happening, that if we were to just take that on a case-by-case basis, as far as adding or an addendum to the minutes, that would be my suggestion.
Commissioner Warren.
I might read here from the corrected minutes. It does state that there's a complete copy of Mr. Phillips' public comment is filed with the official record of the meeting. So it seems that we would all have access to that.
That was for the April minutes. I don't know that there is a complete copy of his comments at the October meeting. However, I guess we probably should decide how we want to handle this overall and in the future. And then we need to decide what we want to do tonight. Do we want to correct the minutes as Mr. Phillips has written, or do we want to ask Mr. Phillips to simply submit, or submit? Mr. Phillips has already already dictated or sent by email, I believe, to our staff person what he felt should be included in the minutes. Either way is fine with me. I mean, I don't really care. But I do think that we need to have a policy so that we know where we're going in the future.
I agree with having a policy, but I think that it happens so rarely that somebody comes and presents us with a correction,
right,
or a better view of, you know, what was said, that we should do it on a case-by-case basis, not make a general rule. I think keeping the minutes to what they are is fine, but if there are things that people want put in the minutes, number one, are they reflected on our webpage with the minutes?
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's fine and dandy that we have them in our packets, but if the public doesn't have access.
Well, I would assume if they become part of the minutes that the public has access.
But if it's a document, is it scanned in and put up there, Jean?
Okay. It'd have to come electronically, I guess. But today, that wouldn't be very hard for anybody to send something electronically.
Not unless it was comments with a 20 or 30 page separate thing that we're not capable of scanning in.
Okay. All right. But, so it doesn't seem like there's a problem with that. And yes, we could deal with it on a case-by-case basis. But and so what would you like to do tonight, ladies and gentlemen?
I would like to include these in either an addendum to tonight's meeting or cut them in half and put part of that April as an addendum to those minutes and then include Mark's comments.
How about if we amend the minutes to include, now has everybody had a chance to read this? Okay. Amend the minutes to include this entire page as an addendum to the minutes. Let's see, how do we do that? Somehow state that there is an attachment with clarification or additions to the minutes requested by the person who made the public comment. Does that work? Okay. Great. Would somebody like to move? Well, okay. Now, are there any other additions or corrections to the minutes? We're not. All we're going to do is approve the minutes. Well, you know, this is unusual, but why don't you go ahead and come up and make your comment? That way, we can get it squared away. To everybody's satisfaction.
That would be great with me. My name is Mark Phillips. I'm from Atascadero, and I really wished I didn't have to go through all this nonsense trying to clean up the statements that I've tried to make in the last several months. First of all, I reject the notion that I'm asking for every single word of my comments to be included in the minutes. I'm not, and the summaries that I've sent to you are in neither case anything approaching that. There's a few sentences that I've added, and that's all. In the case back in October, the minutes as currently on file say exactly the opposite of what I was saying. I mean, they are so off base, it's a little hard to believe that it was just an accident.
This is back in April.
I'm sorry, the minutes from the April meeting about part two of the Pustage story, in which I talk about how the Roy Institute used techniques such as not having anybody with any nutritional expert on the panel that reviewed Pustage data. They wouldn't allow Dr. Pustage to speak. So the Roy Institute did that, and then the Royal Society had another audit, investigation of Pustage, but they also did not have a nutritional expert on board, and they supplied the reviewers with an incomplete set of data. And I said all this as examples of how the industry is coming down in an unfair and unethical manner on the Pustage research. But your notes, your summary of those comments say simply that Mark Phillips Atascadero continued with the controversial story of Dr. Arpad Pusztai's research on adverse health effects from genetically engineered foods that was considered unreliable. Investigations concluded evidence did not support the claims. Does anybody think that reflects what I just said? Seriously, anybody want to defend that? I mean, this is not just a minor little picayune points that I'm trying to make here. The minutes from October, the last Health Commission meeting, are more of the ilk that my entire comments are summed up in a single sentence. I don't think that does an adequate job for somebody who's from the public who hasn't been at these meetings, hasn't seen the thing on TV. They're not going to get anything by reading one sentence that describes my entire three-minute talk. As you said, I suggested a few more sentences. It simply fills it out. That it's a standalone. It makes sense just reading it by itself. Now, you talk about what you should include and what you shouldn't include. Let me make a couple suggestions. One, if a member of the public asks this commission to do something, that needs to be reflected in the minutes, I believe. Because how else are we going to know that, A, the member of the public made that request, and, B, whether or not you ever acted on it? I think that's should be set in concrete. Other than that, I agree with Deborah Donnelly and Pam Hetherington that I don't think this is going to come up very much. I hope it doesn't. I mean, we really need to be more careful. So those are my comments. In terms of the file being on the document being on file, as it is right now, there's a statement that says that, but that's all you get if you go online. There's no link to the document. Now, since we're limited to 3 minutes speaking time, a document that reflected what we said cannot be more than about 550 words, a page. So it's not going to be a major thing to copy it, scan it. And if it's sent electronically, which is usually possible, everything I do is on a computer, I can send it to you on email or whatever, then you don't even have to scan it. And it can be a link then that should be fairly easy to do. That, and again, in terms of how big a envelope you should make to include for the minutes, I think it has to be a standalone document that people can read the minutes and get the gist of what the person's saying. If they want more detail, then they can follow the link or they can request they can look at the video, whatever. But I think that ought to be what your mindset is. And I do appreciate you, in terms of what you should do for me and the two cases that I brought up, I think you should simply line out the minutes as they were recorded originally and put in my version, unless somebody wants to claim that my version is not accurate for some reason or is less helpful. But I think mine is more accurate and more helpful, so I can't see what the argument would be to include my versions that I've conveniently typed for you. You don't even have to type it. It's done for you.
Okay. I think for the April minutes at one point, it seemed like that should be corrected as to how it was submitted. But again, the whole comment that you did make in April is part of the minutes. If it's not electronically available now, we will make it. Hopefully we will be able to do that. Will we be able to do that? Yes. So staff says, yes, we can do that. So that shouldn't be a problem. So thank you for your comments. Are there any further comments from commissioners? And what would we like to do now? Okay. Would someone like to make a motion about accepting the minutes in some form or another?
I move that we accept the minutes of October with the changes proposed, and that we change the April 2006 minutes to reflect what Mr. Phillips has requested.
Okay. Is there a second to this motion? Okay. It's been moved and seconded that we accept the minutes with the following change, that the comments of Mark Phillips be deleted and inserted be the comments that Mr. Phillips typed up. And does that make it complete, though? Yeah, I guess it does. Typed in and submitted. And further, that the April minutes be amended with the comments submitted also by Mr. Phillips. I believe he submitted those comments. Is that everybody's understanding? Right. Well, I meant the comments that were in the minutes the comments by Mark Phillips as printed in the current minutes will be deleted, and inserted will be the proposed comments as submitted by email to our staff. Are we clear? All right. All those in favor? Okay, opposed, abstain, okay. Then the minutes will be amended as stated.
Okay. Did anybody have any other comments on any other part of the minute?
Well,
I assume not.
I think there was one word correction I found. Greening. His first one. Hold on, I'll find it. Yeah. No, it was complaint. It was an incomplete sentence.
If there's any grammatical or spelling errors,
I'll just let
I'm sure that they can just be taken care of by staff. Would that be acceptable, Dr. Thomas?
That would, with the exception of on my comments. I'd like to add, it currently says Dr. Thomas disagreed with a statement made by Mr. Weber on commissioner question comments on the universal health issue regarding persons living shorter lives due to genetics, and it was regarding African-American persons
right.
living shorter lives. So I'd like to put that as an important
okay.
factor.
And I think right below Eric, there's Teresa Weber's comments on Eric Greening. It says Eric Greening states he is an uninsured California.
Should be California.
I'll add it in.
Okay. I guess we have to also vote on the approval of these additions and changes to the minutes. So would someone like to move that they be approved with these further changes? Moved by Commissioner O'Dell and seconded by Commissioner Hetherington. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? Okay, we're good. We'll now move on to the public comment period. This is the time that anyone may make a comment up to 3 minutes that has to do with something other than items on the agenda. If you would please state your name for the record.
My comment summary should read, Elizabeth Johnson, San Luis Obispo, asked for the voluntary or forced resignation of Chairwoman Enns and Vice Chair Hicks due to bias, lack of transparency, ethical violations, and possible conflicts of interest. So, I'm calling for some housekeeping here. I know most of you here are here to serve the health and well-being of our community, and I think it's time to take a look at those who may not be. In the August meeting, the chair intentionally inserted a lie into the public record. Given my experience with the pro-GMO camp, a false accusation is always given to cover up, in this case, the true identity of a pro-GMO paid lobbyist in or close to the commission. Lying is not illegal, but her remark exhibits ethical bankruptcy of a kind I've heard and seen many times since her 10 years chair of both the commission and the task force. I recently was sent the link to our official online ethics course, which I completed, and is now required for all of you. Considering that you and others have so far accepted the chair's behavior, I assume that my sense of ethical standards was outdated. I was wrong. The minimum standards are not outlines to facilitate cheating or what you can get away with in public. They are a baseline legal guide for public trust, which includes transparency. This Health Commission chair and vice chair are not even a blip on the ethical screen, much less operating at its minimum standard. It beneath the minimum standard. suggests that Nita qualified for the minimum education requirements set out for task force members. Yet the vice chair appointed them and the other chair of the committee. As she said, I didn't have to qualify, I was chair. There is history with the vice chair 2 years ago up to the present time. And under her watch, you received one-sided appointees who were and are receiving money directly from industries who would benefit from pro-GMO results. That would also include industries apparently owned by the chair's in-laws. Last June, when it was clear that this commission had a bumpy ride, the vice chair once again used her position as senior nominating committee member to name herself and the chair for a second term. You agreed and voted them in. Today I'm asking you to demand a new action agenda item to publicly discuss the failings of the present Health Commission leadership and request the resignation. By doing so, you might attract a new batch of applicants who actually maintain high personal and public standards. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Next.
Hi, my name is still Mark Phillips, and I'm still from Atascadero. Regarding Chairman N's remarks earlier, giving her justification for making the comment that SLOGE-Free is a paid lobbying group, I would like to correct again Ms. N's, because she's wrong again. We raised money to support Measure Q. Nobody got paid. There's a difference. And you got to play, you know, you're playing loose with the facts when you try to say that we were ever a paid lobbying group. Nobody ever received a dime. In fact, we've spent a lot of money out of our own pocket. It's annoying to have to even talk about this. There's so many more important things to talk about. I think you can probably understand, based on the history that we've had with this task force and with this health commission, how we don't believe we're getting a fair shake here. We said all along that it looked like the selection of the committee for the GE task force was biased. Then when they finally produced the report, we said quite a few very specific things about that report. I mean, you don't have to say anything else, but look at what we said about the report, what we've challenged. Why, for example, did the report not even mention the USDA audit of APHIS, which is the agency that is responsible for the testing for GE test crops? It was an incredible shellacking of that agency. They simply don't have their act together. And it was prominently mentioned in the Santa Cruz Task Force report, the ones who ultimately recommended a precautionary moratorium against the growing of GE crops, wasn't even mentioned in ours. It was only contained in the bibliography. This is the examples, and these are the things that happen when you have a task force that was so incredibly biased. So now all you've done is you've dumped these three conflicting reports on the desks of the Board of Supervisors. What do you expect them to do with it? So I'm going to repeat the thing I said last time, and that is to request you to look at the public health implications of GE crops as contained in those three reports. You don't have to go outside those three reports. Within those three reports is contained all the information you need. You guys need to go through that, read it, discuss it, and come to some conclusions and make some recommendations. Otherwise, I don't believe you're fulfilling your duties to protect the public's health. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Are there any further comments?
Yes. Good evening. My name is Jesse Arnold. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm here to back up the two previous speakers. This does need to be discussed in open session. I've read the bylaws for your group. It says you do need to follow the Brown Act. The whole thing with the task force, you did not follow the Brown Act. And then the dereliction of duty on the part of the chairman for not sending the letter regarding SB 1056. And the chairman has been detailed in written material talking about her connections with Farm Bureau. She's never denied that. This is the opportunity. We've denied what she said about us, but if she's going to deny that, then I want to hear that. But regardless of that, the commission did not follow the Brown Act. And I think this ought to be put on the agenda and discussed in the open. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Are there any further comments from the public? Okay. I will make a comment simply because
it seems like I need to do that. First of all, I have no connection with the Farm Bureau. Second of all, I was appointed the chairman of the GMO Task Force, and as I told everyone there at the meetings, I was there to facilitate the group. I was not there to do the research. I was not there to give my opinion as to whether GMO foods are good or not good. The group was, I believe, a hard-working, unbiased group. The Brown Act was followed to the letter. And this commission, the Brown Act, is followed to the letter. And so you'd have to be really specific in if you feel that there are violations of the Brown Act, and I suggest that maybe you contact county council. So that's all the comment that I have about that. I did not intentionally ever not send a letter. We had a situation with staff, didn't realize they were supposed to send a letter out. Got put on the back burner. I had no idea the letters had not gone. As far as I was concerned, the letters were gone to all the elected representatives. So I believe that your accusations are groundless, and I think that's all I'm going to say on the subject ever again. Thank you very much. Now, we'll move on if there are no further public comments to the next agenda item, which is the San Luis Obispo County Parks and Recreation Element. Peter Jenny is here again to give us a further update, and as I recall, members of the commission were going to further read the and I know Commissioner Donnelly probably read every word of the element, so thank you for being here.
Thank you, Peter Jenny, Parks Manager. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm not sure that I particularly have anything to add to my comments from last month. I think the reason for coming to you specifically and asking for your endorsement is I think the nexus is probably clear to everybody here between health and wellness and parks and recreation opportunities. I won't read through all of them, even though they're fairly brief, but I'll share with you just a bit of what I intend to open with our presentation with the board tomorrow. And that's, among other things, in addition to the fact that this element helps support our tourist industry and helps attract healthy businesses and residents and so forth, that it works toward improving our health. That it's been well documented that the stress reduction of being in parks and open spaces contributes to wellness, that the these opportunities for exercise actually even contribute to reduce crime, because the levels of aggression go down when people have an opportunity to calm down a little bit and de-stress. I don't have to tell this commission the fact that in this country, 2 out of 3 adults are now either overweight or obese, and that our children are rapidly becoming, or on the verge of becoming, the first generation not to outlive their parents. But I'm going to share that with the board and the public tomorrow. And that activity is, along with things like diet and, to some extent, even genetics, I suppose, are key factors in fighting obesity. And so for all those reasons, I think that we have a natural connection here. Our staff is working more closely with the Obesity Task Force. I think there is a huge future of parks and recreation working much more closely with the health industry. Last comment, something else I'll be sharing with the board tomorrow. This element that we're updating is our 1968 element. Now, I was in high school in 1968. 68, that's not a typo or a slip of the tongue. Almost 40 years old. And interestingly enough, in my industry, in 1968, parks were basically just viewed as a place to go and play. And that was their function. That was good enough. And we could afford to do that as a society. Obviously, we are one of those functions. There are many others that have had to fight more and more for fewer dollars in the last 15 or 20 years. And because of that, as an industry, we have looked more closely at really what our core issues are about. And it's made us kind of examine the benefits that we provide that we've always kind of taken for granted, because we didn't really have to explain ourselves to the community. I'm not saying that's good or bad, it's just kind of the way it was. And we have come to realize that we do help fight crime, and we do help fight obesity, and we contribute to health issues, and we do help with the economy and all of those sort of things. And I think part of our mission nowadays is to explain that to people, why this is a good thing to support parks, recreation, and open space. And I think working in partnership with the health industry, the health commission, with the health department, is an important part of us serving the community, because We provide everything from opportunities for health programs to be carried out in our parks to another venue for education. There's so many ways we can and should, and I think we'll be working together in the future. So I'm here to answer questions that you may have, and I'm hoping that this evening you will be prepared to send, because we're first in the agenda tomorrow morning, first after the consent calendar, we're the first public hearing, and we are hoping that we will have some support to urge the board to adopt the element as presented.
Commissioner Hamilton? Pete, the 14 trails that were removed, could you enlighten me why we're removing them rather than adding them?
Yeah, I could share with you some of the basic information behind that. The projects list as a whole, and it is an extensive part of the document. The projects list was trails proposed, park locations, all types of recreational facilities. Came out of about 2 years of public meetings and just kind of, folks, what would you like? And we, basically, it was kind of brainstorming. We took in everything that was essentially was requested. If we heard it, certainly if we heard it more than once, in some cases, there's probably a few projects that we heard them one time from a given group, added them to the list. The filtering process that went on after that, and the process of going through the Park Commission review, was part of what happened, is we looked at some of these routes, and quite frankly, they're mostly routes in the more remote parts of the county. And understanding that one of the things we were striving to do, recognizing the importance of agriculture in this county, as it's probably, well, it's the second largest industry behind tourism, that we had to have a program that was, that balanced viable agriculture with public recreation. We couldn't sacrifice a business as important as ag just to provide places for recreation without some significant reason for doing that. So in looking at that, our policies say essentially, if you stay in agriculture, you will not be conditioned for a trail as a result of projects you do that relate to agriculture. So consequently, those trails that were proposed, you know, out in the rural areas, heading out, you know, mostly North County and East County, are lands that are largely agricultural today, and quite frankly, we think will be staying in agriculture for years to come. So the immediacy of the need was diminished in our minds. And we felt that we could buy a certain level of comfort from a community that frankly did not particularly trust what we were saying. When we said, if you stay in ag, we won't ask for a trail, we found that it was appropriate to bide our time. It wasn't, those trails were not ripe yet. Because we do have policies that say if something happens that we don't anticipate, a new town crops up, a major new subdivision comes out of no place, we do have policies that will allow us to review those for opportunities for trails, even if there's not a plan in place, if there's not a line on a map. So a Varian Ranch type project comes out of no place out on Highway 58 that nobody saw coming in the next 38 years that this element will survive. There are still policies that let us review that and see if it would be appropriate to ask for trails. So it was kind of balancing what was necessary with, you know, showing the issue of trust, that we don't have to ask for everything today because we will have more opportunities in the future as we grow and say, okay, now the time is right because growth is increasing into this region. So maybe it's time to start putting those trails on the plan, on the map. It's the same reason that we added language that said we will not use eminent domain. It wasn't even on our radar because in the 16 years I've been here, no one has even discussed the notion of using eminent domain to acquire a trail or a park site. It's just not going to fly here. So we never even considered saying we're not going to do it because we never thought about it. The community came to us and said, we don't trust you, essentially. Government's going to take land when they can. So we added into our policies, we're not going to use eminent domain. So part of it's trying to show people, it's kind of a belt and suspenders approach, that we really mean what we say to try to garner some trust.
So will this list be in some archive so that, you know, if that very much development does creep up, then you've got kind of your cheat sheet in the back?
Yeah, I think, I mean, certainly staff knows what's out there in the areas that we're concerned about. I think as the community changes and evolves over the next 38 years, I think those will come to the forefront. The thing we are trying to keep in mind is that elements of the general plan can be amended up to 4 times a year and are done generally at least 3 times a year. And there will be more opportunities as they present when we see that encroachment arriving. But we've been focusing on connecting communities to communities and communities to recreational areas. And having and going out into the hinterland, if you will, we just felt it was premature.
Commissioner Wynn?
Yes.
What percentage of these public trails were proposed out in the hinterlands? How much of these were going to be on public lands, and what percentage was going to be on private land?
My recollection, and understand there's a lot of proposals out here, but my recollection is that all of the trails that we're proposing for deletion, all the trails we're proposing for deletion were on public rights of way. The vast majority of the projects that we're proposing are on public rights of way. Now, I'll make the distinction. I'm not trying to play with words here. I mean, most of the roads in this county are not owned by the Public Works Department of the county in fee. Most of them are public rights of way. I'm not trying to split hairs here, because underlying that road, underlying probably Highway 58, that's private property under the road. But there's been a long-established right for the public to use that corridor. Those are the places that we cited most of our trails. We do have a handful of trails that are proposed to work with willing sellers and to work when land converts from agriculture. That's the only time we'll be asking for a trail, is when it converts from agriculture. We do have a handful of trails that cross private property in places like the Salinas River, because it's such an important asset. And in fact, it is coincidental with the Juan Batista, the Anza Trail, one of very few national historic trails in this country that are also part of our local trails plan. So we do have a few places where we're saying, yes, we need to cross private property when it converts from agriculture to residential uses, for example. But the vast majority of the trails are on public roads along the road right away. And frankly, it strikes us a bit odd that 100 years ago, I don't think anybody would have been arguing about the right of someone to ride a horse on a public road. So we didn't have cars. We're back to that again.
Commissioner O'Dell?
Yeah, I have a question about process. This is a general master plan, or I call it, you call it element?
It's an element of the county's general plan.
And which is a long-range plan.
Yes, it's the big picture.
Now, specifically on the trails, when you have a trail that you're proposing, it's funded, and so forth, what is the process going to go through on that particular trail?
It's outlined in some detail in the plan, but when it comes time to actually, let me take a step back. There's a lot of process. Our intention is not to propose to develop trails until we have a point A to point B that we can link a community to a park, one park to a library, something like that. We don't want random little links to the chain that just end and don't go anyplace. What we'll be doing initially, and what we have been doing for the last 15 years, is acquiring the right-of-way. So when we connect all the links to get from a point A to a point B, where there's a reasonable place for people to go from public property to public property, then we begin the process of trying to develop the trail. At that point, we go through the same environmental process that any other developer does. And there's noticing process, there's environmental review, we have to go through the CEQA process. We're proposing in this, for example, if those trails are in areas that happen to be near agriculture, that we're not going to put trails through ag lands, even working with a willing seller, that have mitigation, that have impacts that can't be mitigated. There's a whole series of steps we'll have to go through. But likewise, if we're near a creek, we have to mitigate the impacts on the riparian zone. It's a very lengthy process, and it's one reason why the 1991 trails plan, which some of you are familiar with and has dozens of trails, I think we have completed since 91 three of those, maybe four, that weren't wholly contained within a county regional park at some place.
So the process is public to open hearings?
Absolutely.
And what about acquiring the land? Is that public?
It is as well, because even the acquisition of those easements is subject to the CEQA process. And we have to go to the Board of Supervisors and have a public hearing just to accept. Staff doesn't have the ability to accept an easement. Even a willing seller comes to us and says, here, we're going to give it to you. We still have to go to the board to accept it. So it's a very transparent, very public process.
So the whole thing is a public process?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
As we think it should be.
Commissioner Donnelly?
Thank you for your information. I really just had a question, you know, because we want to help support this at the Board of Supervisors meeting tomorrow. And trying to figure out a way that we can best support it, you know, with regards to the health element of it. I just really want to ask you, I mean, just from my own reading, one of the things I know is that it's clear that this county has fallen short of being able to provide this Parks and Rec, which is a very important thing for us to have as a community and also for, you know, to help retain and attract tourists to the area. Is there anything specific that would be helpful for us to emphasize to the Board of Supervisors? Some of the thoughts that I had were on, you know, making sure that they would be willing to commit to some of this funding. And I know you had mentioned last time that you weren't going to go there yet, and so would that help or would that hurt for us to do that? And some of the other things I was thinking about is could we... some of the things I would like to see is some of these parks and some of the trails that you were talking about that link communities to be brought up into communities where, you know, we have a lot of problems now with childhood obesity. So areas where we have high incidence of this, are these elements that we could help with? And which ones, if you could specify, could you help us out?
I have rarely been accused of being overly bold in the public process, so I'll let others decide if that's a strength or a weakness. That's part of the reason for not making funding an issue now, because quite frankly, my concern is, at one point early on in the process, we looked at a lot of models of what other people have done with elements, and what some places have done is they put a dollar figure on every project based on, you know, today's dollars, and frankly, it's scary when you start doing that, and it's an easy way to scare people away. And we likened it to a young couple who's dating, sat down and said, well, you know, if we get married and we have kids and we have to send them to school, what's it going to cost? You know, we'd probably be extinct as a species if we did that. You know, you just have to kind of take that leap of faith and know things will work out. So we thought it was, that's why we didn't want to go to the money issues. And I still think that's important. But my long about getting back to your answer is, and I think I mentioned this last month, our next step, once this plan is adopted, is to look at where the priorities are, look at the needs assessments, and going into places that, anecdotally, staff is pretty sure we know where those areas are. There are places like San Miguel and Oceano and places where there aren't a lot of opportunities beyond public recreation for children especially, but everybody, and focus there. I think the thing that this, and backing up that thought, I think the thing that we've been viewed as important is we need to plan first. We need to figure out, because right now we're working from nothing. We're working from scratch. The 68 element, my throwaway line is it's got a chapter on hunting, a chapter on fishing, and a chapter on scratching, and that's about it. It is so badly out of date that the planning department doesn't even show it to people anymore if they come and say, show me the rec element. So the plan is important itself, and I guess what I would urge this commission is if you are prepared to support it, is to point out to the board those health values, that nexus between wellness and health, and this being a healthier community as a result of this. Because you're right, we have fallen badly short. When we have national standards that say we should have, give or take, 6 acres of parkland per 1,000 residents, community parkland, that's target which I would point out the city of San Luis Obispo has figured out how to meet, in fact exceed. And here in the countywide, in our unincorporated communities, it's less than 2. And we're now, at the urging of the Planning Commission, being so bold as to suggest in the latest draft 3 acres per 1,000. And not even address how far away those parks are from people, because that's an issue that the current thinking is you need to have those parks close to people. It's not how many acres, it's how close to get to a park or a trail. I think pointing out those issues of why this is a wellness thing, why the people and citizens of this community and the visitors who come here will be better off if we adopt this plan, that's the most important thing we can do. And we'll worry about the figuring out, that's staff's next big job, is to go out and come up with some ideas for the board as to how, well, A, what we need to do next, and then B, how do we pay for it. And we're pretty good at finding other people's money. We're pretty good at finding grants and other programs to bring those funds in. But without having a roadmap, it's going to continue to be just kind of hit or miss. And we're paying the price of that as a nation. I mean, again, you guys know the progression, obesity is just one example, the progression of how much fatter we're becoming as a nation. It's happening right here as well. The same thing's happening with our crime rates, the same thing's happening with our stress level and all those other things. Our view has always been, this is San Luis Obispo. We can do better. We should do better. And that's the kind of message I think you all can send the board, I think, to listen to.
Are there any other questions from the commissioners? Dr. Thomas.
If the commission decides to support this, it might be helpful if there was a commissioner who was willing to sit in on the next step, which is the process of prioritization, because having the health perspective represented on how the next step of prioritization I think would be very valuable, and hopefully planning will ask and hopefully we can offer somebody also from public health staff to sit on that prioritization.
Are you expecting that that will come out of the that there will be like a task force to work on the prioritization at that point? Is that what you think the next step will be?
I don't know. Ask Mr. Jenny. I thought that's what I heard.
That would be our intent as next steps. I mean, my hope is that if the board takes tentative action tomorrow to adopt right. this, they come back on December 5th when they formally adopt it, just because there is a two-step noticing process. After we've had a few celebratory refreshing cold water to feel good about what we did and get through the holidays, our next task, come the first of the year, is start looking at that notion of priorities. And we would welcome input from any number of people, including this commission, to help us with sorting through that. I'll be honest with you, we don't know exactly what that process is going to look like yet, because we've been focused for almost six years on getting the roadmap together. But we would welcome your help.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, is there, we do have a possible action item for this item. And so do we want to take action, Commissioner O'Dell?
Well, I thought we supported it in concept at the last meeting.
We did.
And this was to, if there are some details or something we want to emphasize, was my understanding of it, that then we would bring that up, and then somebody would go from the Health Commission to present it tomorrow, if we had, other than in concept.
All right. So does the commission wish to send a representative to the Board of Supervisors meeting tomorrow to support the, to go further than, state one, that we support it in concept, and which we've already advised them that we do, and also to maybe speak more specifically of the, Mr. Jenny said, the wellness health link with the POX element, and how we see the future of our population surviving and not becoming totally obese. Do we need a motion to send someone, Dr. Thomas, do you think, or can we just decide?
No, my understanding last month was that you voted to support it in concept, made notation on how to access it, and asked commission members to look at it and come back and see whether there was going to be something beyond a support in concept, i.e., and was there going to be a vote to support the recreation element, which then could, emphasizing the health benefits of a well-planned and adequate recreation space.
So the difference, I understand it, is that we are now going, we voted that we supported it in concept, now we're going to say we support it as proposed. And I think you're right, I think that was what Commissioner Donnelly asked, to have an opportunity to read it in detail. So, Commissioner Hetherington.
I move that the commission support the Park and Rec element update as a good roadmap to community wellness. And I hope somebody is available to go and explicate that tomorrow in front of the board.
Okay, there's a motion to...
I second that.
And it's been seconded. Is there any discussion on the motion? All right, then all those in favor? Opposed? Abstain? The motion is passed with one abstention. Now we need a volunteer to go to the meeting tomorrow.
I wish that I could, but I have a commitment all day tomorrow. I'm in class. I'm very sorry. I would love to do that.
Yeah.
I can't.
You would do a nice job. Is there anybody else who would be able to go to the Board of Supervisors tomorrow? I guess it looks like I'll be going to the Board of Supervisors tomorrow.
I was planning on going for the presentation to the Environmental Center in the morning. How much time are we looking at on morning?
That's why I'm back up here, at the risk of further scaring off a volunteer. Let me kind of tell you what we see happening. We are the first hearing item. We are item C1, so that's the first hearing item after the consent calendar. Now, under the best of circumstances, and there's only one or two items on presentation before the consent calendar, so under the best of circumstances, we would have expected to be up by about 10 o'clock. We'd begin our presentation, and then public comment will follow immediately after that. And we've got about a 20-minute presentation by the time we're done, so by 10:30. I will share with you, and I think Dr. Thomas can attest to this because he's probably been in a few of these meetings recently, public comment period has been extremely extended as of late, largely due to the issues going on with the wastewater facilities in Los Osos. So the last meeting I attended, in fact, a couple of weeks ago, I think we were something like an hour and a half of public comment. So it could be late in the morning before that opportunity to speak comes up. But that said, it will be an issue that it's, I think it's important that board members hear from a voice that's there in present, because we know there will be people who say that this is too much, we shouldn't be doing this.
Dr. Thomas, are you planning on going?
It depends what time it is.
Well, I think that, you know, if Chair Enns is able to go and you go, that between the two of you, you should be able to paint a good roadmap to the connection between what they're trying to do to prevent, you know, childhood obesity and, you know, getting people out there to exercise so that...
I have a meeting with my boss at 11, so it really depends on what my boss says, whether that meeting needs to go forward or not.
Okay. But you can stress to Mr. Hamm that it's very important.
Is it possible, I'm just curious, to have someone that can, like, call when... so you're not sitting there all morning waiting?
Sure. Jean can call.
Well, I suppose I could be listening to it on the television and then just figure it's going to be half an hour more.
I suspect there are going to be a number of people making public comment on this issue, so depends how far away you are.
Yeah, well, okay. Long ways, actually, but fine. I will represent the commission tomorrow at the Board of Supervisors because the commission and I personally believe this is a very important issue, and we really need to have it made clear beyond our letter. So that's the end of that subject. We'll move to the next agenda item, but I would like to thank you again, Mr. Jenny, for being here. I would like to ask our audiovisual people, all I've seen is the windows. Are we actually, because we're not, all we have on the screen here is the Windows desktop. Yeah, thank you. Okay, I just was concerned because, I was concerned because if our presenters have something for the audience to see, they might like to see it. Okie doke. The next item is the tobacco cessation programs, an overview being given by Susan Hughes from the SLO County Tobacco Control Program. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Commissioner Chairperson Ahnes and members of the Commission. My name is Susan Hughes. I'm the Director of the Tobacco Control Program. First, I want to share with you some statistics in our county. Our adult smoking rates as of 2003 were 16%. The state of California at 2005 was 14%. I apologize, but I can't find equal year numbers. Some of the data statistics don't come out at the same time. Our youth smoking rates in 2005 were 20%. And the state of California youth smoking rates were 13.2%. So I guess in short what I'm saying is we do have a challenge in San Luis Obispo County with both adult and youth smoking rates. Now, in order to have my presentation run, I have to say next each time I want a new slide. And voila, there it goes. Okay. I do want to give you a quick overview of our tobacco control program. It is patterned and developed to reduce smoking rates because in a long-term fashion, and we know that this takes a comprehensive approach. The state of California supports community norm change, which is changing the environment, for example, smoke-free work sites, beaches, and parks, rather than changing individual behavior, such as smoking cessation. So just to give you an idea of that, the original Prop 99 monies that came down in 1988 are focused on prevention and education, and you can see the amounts we get annually. We get $110,000 of master settlement agreement money locally. We actually get a total of $220,000. Half of that effort, or that money, goes to the prevention side, half goes to the cessation side. Our staffing includes what's listed there, a half-time director, which is me, a full-time health education specialist, a half-time administrative assistant, and we delight in having Cal Poly interns who are very, very helpful to our efforts. Sometimes we have two, and sometimes we have none, so we just hope for more than none. Next. So our prevention education focuses in reducing youth access to tobacco products, reducing secondhand smoke, and countering pro-tobacco influences, or all the advertising you see. It really is limited. It's very limited in cessation and really has no money for cessation. Next. So our cessation services, what are they about and what kind of funding do we get? In 1997, there was one part-time counselor. That's when I joined the program, and there was really no dedicated funding to support a stop smoking program. Then around in 2001, we received the master settlement funding and Prop 10 funding, and we really began to work on providing and expanding cessation services. The CDC best practices of comprehensive tobacco control program budget suggests that programs in a county the size of San Luis County should receive an upper estimate of $1.7 million and a lower estimate of $640,000. In Still County, with all of the funding streams that we're talking about from Prop 99, the Master Settlement, and Prop 10, we're receiving currently a little over $500,000, which is about 81% of the lower estimate from the CDC. Next. We have one small program called the Tobacco Free Youth Project. A lot of people don't know about this one. Participants are youth who are cited under PC 308. In other words, they're underage and they've been caught smoking. Our program is designed as an alternative to paying a court-ordered fine, which can be as high as up to $260. We provide a four-hour class on Saturdays, and we do this four times a year, once per quarter. We charge $50. This is the only program that we charge a fee for out of all the programs we run. In 2004, we had 50 youth attend. In 2005, we had 56 youth. We're currently doing a new outreach effort to the courts to increase awareness by the courts of the program, because we really feel like going through this program, the youth is better served than just by paying a fine. So there's a brochure in your packet that's brand new that's just gone over to the courts to encourage the judges to make sure the families are aware of the program. Next. Our Prop 10 program is called Baby's First Breath. The program objective is to provide stop smoking services annually to 50 pregnant moms, 50 parents and family members of children 0 to 5, and also to provide information on the harmful effects of secondhand smoke to at least 180 parents. We throw in that secondhand smoke piece because we believe that if you can educate people about secondhand smoke, especially parents, it's more effective than saying you shouldn't smoke around your child. If you can talk to them about how it's harming their child, then eventually we hope that they will change their behavior and decide to quit. So it's a step before quitting. Next. Our adult cessation services, we call them our general cessation services. This program was primarily modeled after the Mayo Clinic program and the recommendations of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. It does include multiple session or contacts with each participant. Individual counseling is available to those who request it, and I want to emphasize no one is turned away. So our intervention strategies does include one-on-one counseling, support groups, phone support, and our mailed materials, and we're lucky we can provide nicotine replacement therapy to those folks who do qualify, who can't get it in any other way. And for instance, if people aren't really ready to join a group or come into our office, we can also refer them to the California Smokers Helpline. Next. We also do include a participant assessment. The initial contact includes a discussion on the smoker's true motivation and desire to quit. The program expectations and requirements are discussed. For example, we talk about the minimum number of counseling contacts that are required before anyone can receive nicotine replacement therapy. The result is a self-screening by participants who sometimes recognize they are not truly ready to meet the challenge of quitting their addiction to tobacco. And that's what it is. It is an addiction, and so we treat it in that manner. They decide whether they're ready during that phone call. After the assessment, and they decide they want to come into it, we look at where they live, and we try and put them in a class or in counseling near where they live, so we are able to offer classes, counseling in Morro Bay, Paso Robles, River Beach, and San Luis Obispo. We also, if they're not really ready to quit yet, we offer to mail materials and keep in contact with them over the phone, or we can also refer them to the Nicotine Anonymous groups that are around in the county. If relapse does occur then, if someone has gone through a program, then a participant can re-enter a class or counseling at any time. Our group sizes vary, as do any support groups. For example, last week we had 6 participants sign up for a new class that was starting. 1 showed up, so the counselor did the best she could with the person who did come. So you never quite know. They're just like any other support group. They're a little hard to figure out what might happen during each class. Next. Our adult cessation services do have some program requirements. We do ask the participants to participate in a minimum of 4 individual group sessions. They must establish a quit date, identify common smoking cues, and develop a plan for high-risk situations, develop a behavioral change daily plan, and discuss feelings and behavior associated with nicotine use. The services are structured. They're not meant to be a drop-in service. We feel like Nicotine Anonymous groups provide that. However, if a participant who has previously been in a class and they want to come back just to get some support, they can come in and drop into any class that they would like to. I should mention, too, that the nicotine replacement therapy it can be given for up to 6 weeks, but we are the provider, as I said before, of last resort. Next. What type of outreach do we do? We have many program brochures. We try to do them both in English and Spanish, and most of them are in your packet. We do biannual mailings to various healthcare facilities, community agencies, school districts, childcare, all those ones listed up there and more, and there's a list of that in your packet. We post classes and programs in our health agency, Public Health Newsletter, and that comes out quarterly and is mailed to about 700 folks. We do our TV and radio ads, and we are posted on the health agency website. I have to admit we're working on getting better with information, getting that out there. That's sort of new to us as far as being able to update it on a regular basis, so we're getting better at that. In addition, our health educator that's employed by the program makes one-on-one visits to physicians, healthcare providers, hospitals, and clinics, including community health centers of the Central Coast to distribute our materials, and also meets with staff at clinics and hospitals regarding referral processes and program components. Next. The next thing I want to show you is one of our TV commercials. This is a commercial that blends messages for a comprehensive approach. It combines prevention or community norm change with a message on cessation or individual behavior change. It talks about the harmful effects of secondhand smoke, which is an environmental message. It talks about litter, tobacco butts, which is an environmental message, and it talks about smoking around kids, which is a first step stop smoking message. So we think it's pretty cost effective. It sends multiple messages at the same time, and I'm going to say next, and we'll hope it plays.
The Central Coast has beautiful, pristine beaches, and we'd like to keep them that way. But secondhand smoke and toxic litter caused from cigarettes are ruining our beaches. During a recent beach cleanup day, 20,000 cigarette butts were collected in just 3 hours off our local beaches. Cigarettes and secondhand smoke are a big threat to our health and our beaches. To learn more about supporting smoke-free beaches, call the Public Health Department Tobacco Control Program at 781-5564.
We've also actually done some other overlays of that commercial with For Help on Quitting, call us too, so that we can use that basic message in many other formats. And in radio, it's the same thing with a little bit different message. So we're only with some statistics data and results. We have a pretty good cessation evaluation piece in your packet. So I've just pulled out a few of those graphs for you this evening to show you. In the past 5 years, we've provided services to 1,218 folks. 347 of those were on the First Five program, or the Pregnant Moms and Children 0-5 program. And their mean six-month quit rate was 34%, which is pretty good. The general population folks were 871, and they had this is over the five-year period, a cessation, six-month cessation quit rate of 46%. So we feel that our program is fairly effective. I can tell you that those numbers break down kind of up and down over the years. In 2001-02, we had 162 clients. We were just ramping up our program. When we were fully staffed with four contractors, we had, in 2002-03, there were 254 clients. In 2003-04, we lost some counselors. We went down to three. Our clients dropped down. It's a capacity issue with us, 182 clients. In 2004-05, because we had to change our counselors were changed to temp help counselors, we were only able to have one. We budgeted for it. It's not a budget issue, but just the maneuverings of the county and staffing and hiring, we had only one temp help counselor, and our numbers fell to 124. We just didn't have the number of folks in all the regions in order to be able to service that many people. In 2005-06, we were building again. We had two counselors at 149 and serviced 149 folks. Last week, we finally hired a third temp help person who can speak Spanish, which has been a challenge for us as well. So we're looking for those numbers to go up again. Next. Mm-hmm. Go back. Okay.
I don't understand the quit rate. If you have 34 and 46, how do you get to 26? Maybe just go back and take a look at a later time.
I will. I will ask our evaluator. Thank you.
Tonight.
Next. Types of cessation services. This is just a quick graph showing you that 62% went through individual counseling and 29 group classes, then went on down from there, and that's just for that 1 year, 05-06. Next. The six-month quit rate by program component by 05-06, just the 1 year, this may make more sense, 39% first five, 26% general population, and a total of 35%. There must have been a typo on that other one. I will check. Thank you. Overall satisfaction. We did want to get an idea of what is our program okay? Is client satisfaction surveys. So we have, over the last year and a half or so, we've randomly given satisfaction surveys, and is 151 of our clients, and you can see that majority of the folks are very satisfied with the services. Next. How about with the elements of the tobacco cessation class? What do you like? Program materials, cessation specialists, location. The program materials seem to be useful. Most folks were very satisfied with them. Cessation specialists seems to be very helpful, and the locations seem to be very convenient. So we're happy with those results. Next. Was the class helpful in quitting? And you can see that most folks thought, yes, it was very or somewhat helpful. There's some other statistics in your packet, like what did you like most about the class? 37% of the folks indicated the group support, sharing, and honesty. 15% said the way the information is given and the techniques that are used. And 14% said that we like the specialist or the group leader. And, of course, it went down from there for materials and daily meetings and that sort of thing. What did you like the least? Most folks think it should be longer. It should last more weeks. 35% said that. Changing nothing, 26% of the folks said that. It went down from there. So we use these to help us out a bit, but overall I think we're doing fairly well. Next. I'm going to share another TV commercial with you. This is Your Baby is Precious. This has really more direct information about the dangers of secondhand smoke and smoking while pregnant. And again, that ETS, or the secondhand smoke message, we hope will get to the parents of young kids and help them to begin to think about quitting if they're not ready to quit. Okay.
Your baby is precious. You wouldn't do anything to harm him. But if you smoke during pregnancy, you are harming your baby. You're risking a premature birth, low birth weight, underdeveloped lungs, or sudden infant death syndrome. Smoking around your child can cause asthma, bronchitis, pneumonia, and allergies. Protect your children or unborn baby. Quit smoking and avoid secondhand smoke. For free help on quitting, call the Public Health Department Tobacco Control Program at 781-5564.
Next. And that concludes our presentation.
Thank you very much. That was an excellent presentation. Are there any questions from the commissioners? Commissioner Hetherington.
So just how many tobacco cessation classes are there?
Well, I think in your packet there was an example of a listing of how we do our classes. In other words, we have two orientation classes. One, over the first 2 weeks would be on a Wednesday night, for instance. There'll be one orientation class, and then the second week one orientation class. And then there are four classes the following week, and then a follow-up class. So it's a series of classes. And we try to do, for instance, we usually have one going in Paso Robles and one going in Rio Grande and one going in San Luis Obispo over that month's time period. Now, I'm going to tell you that in December, we're not going to do classes because nobody comes. So we've learned this over the years. You know, it's just silly for us to be doing something where we're not going to have anybody attending. In January, after the first of the year and all the, you know, let me do a resolution, we'll be having lots of classes. So we do try and gear it to the interest and times of year and that sort of thing.
Thank you, Susan. Any other questions from the commissioners? Commissioner Warren.
Were these classes, is it on an ongoing basis? I mean, like when one class finishes within a few weeks, the next class is going to start in the same place? Because that's been some frustration out in the community, is knowing that consistency is just a big piece for helping people with their addictions.
And it's been a large frustration for us as well. We've only been at this for 2 or 3 years, and of course I shared with you a little bit about our staffing challenges. But in the last year or so, we've tried to get it more regular, shall we say. I mean, we sat down, we actually modified our class schedule. You know, over the last 6 months or so, we were doing one orientation class and then 5 days of classes and then one follow-up. And as we got input from the folks who are attending, they said, well, we need more time to think about quitting and setting that quick date, some orientation. And so we've changed that so that it better serves the clients. You know, like I said, in December, we're not going to have classes. We can always set up an individual counseling happens at all times as well. So it's not that it's in December we may not be able to have anyone. I mean, we won't have our classes going, but if somebody really needs to talk to somebody, they can come and talk to a counselor. So we're working on being much more consistent. The difficulty with set days and times is with each class, we have like I know we had one problem where we scheduled a noon class in San Luis and a 5 o'clock class in Grover Beach, and one counselor was doing it, and she realized very quickly after the first class, she's part-time, she has another job, she couldn't do that, so the class in that case shifted to from a Tuesday to a Wednesday, one of the groups. And so there is some of, we've learned that now, so that doesn't happen anymore. For the most part, I think you can, we posted from October and November classes, and they remained solid, and we intend for that to happen.
Okay, I have another question. Given our averages for both our youth and our adults are above state averages, is there any foreseeable time in the future where you might work together, say, with CHC and the hospitals to really look at what we can do to provide maybe a broader menu of treatment opportunities for people, and working directly with their healthcare provider who could then recommend that they do that and be able to do some follow-up? Because I just don't think we're, you know, you've done a beautiful job with environmental concerns and the public policy and all that. I mean, we're outstanding for this county. But when it comes to treatment, you know, you can tell by our percentages we're lacking. And it seems like there could be more coordination among the healthcare providers on that.
Well, we're working toward that as well. As I mentioned, our health educator is now, since the, we had actually a little, it took a little time in between the time the county clinics changed over to CHCCC, and we've been going out doing in-services for those providers and working with physicians one-on-one to talk about referral and the fact that our services are available. So we're working hard to doing that. Our health educator was just out at French Hospital a couple weeks ago doing in-services to that staff. So I think you're right. I mean, there's no end to where we could go. Again, it's a little bit of a capacity issue with us, and I know that seems like a, you know, that doesn't solve the problem. But the other piece that we worked hard to is to incorporate tobacco education prevention into the perinatal outreach substance abuse initiative, and to link up with those folks too, and saying that tobacco is, you know, we want the OBGYNs to think of tobacco in the same way they think of alcohol. That's been kind of hard, because given if somebody's doing meth, we've been told this, if somebody's doing meth, they'll say get off the meth but keep smoking. So we're out there trying to educate folks like that too. And so it's a long road to haul, but we're, yes.
The other thing is that as we discuss with the Santa Barbara Regional Health Authority staff, contemplating expansion of managed care Medi-Cal into this county, I think that the providers themselves are providing some tobacco cessation services, and indeed hopefully will be rewarded financially for doing that. Obviously there's a lot of public-private partnership possibilities that we will continue to be looking at.
I just had one question. Are there other ongoing classes offered by other organizations such as American Lung or Cancer Society? Or
not in this county.
Not in this county.
We're it.
Are there any other questions from the commissioners? Oh, Commissioner Donnelly.
Thanks. I just had a question. When you do have somebody that's referred, and let's say they're referred to you, whether it's through a doctor or they call and say that they're interested in a class, but maybe that class is ongoing right now, what do you do? How do you maintain that relationship with that person? Do you contact them again when the next class is coming? Or if you see that they don't come, you had mentioned that only one person showed up for the support group. I'm just wondering what's the process of maintaining that the potential clients' names and following up with them?
Yeah, well, what will happen is the health educator in the program is the person who initially talks to anybody, really, and she does that initial assessment. And if they're in the middle of the classes, by then we do know there are other, you know, what month or what when the next class will begin. And then depending on what they say, I mean, you know, that name will be handed off to, say if they live in Paso Robles, to one of our cessation counselors, to the cessation counselor who works out of Paso Robles, and then she would be in contact with the person to again reinforce when the next class would be and kind of start a rapport with them. If they're fine and happy, we also mail them materials at that point in time. We try and get enough information that we can shoot out some materials on the classes and some of the information that you've seen in your packet. So we don't lose them. Although we do lose them. I mean, we just had an example tonight where we had someone who was interested in starting up a Nicotine Anonymous class, and we had lost him to follow up. The phone number changed. Then we found his phone number, and then it was just one of those kind of surveillance things that you'd have to do sometimes. But we try the best we can to follow up and keep them interested in quitting and give them enough information initially to contemplate what they will be experiencing in the class once they get there.
Mr. Grena?
Are you having any impact on the tobacco advertising in the county?
We're trying, but it's hard. That's one of the harder places to work because of the it's protected by the First Amendment. And so one of the things we're doing right now is doing a voluntary effort on merchants in the north and coastal regions to see if they take down some of their ads. So, but it's all voluntary. We can't do policy work. It's one of the harder of the environmental kind of social norm change areas in which to work, unfortunately.
Thank you very much for a very nice presentation, and we really appreciate your time and the effort and what you are doing.
Well, I appreciate your time and your efforts as well. Thank you very much.
All right, now we're about halfway through the evening. Do we need to take a short break, 5 minutes? Everybody's good? All right, then we'll move ahead. So our next speaker is Dana Ravelin, who is going to speak to us on the survey results of the preschool family nutrition and physical activity knowledge and practices. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back. It's been just a little over 6 months, I think, since I was last here. This evening, what I would like to do is share with you the actual parent survey results that we took in the individual preschool sites almost a year ago now, when we were actually compiling the height and weight and BMI data for our preschool children countywide. So this is a lot of graphs, and hopefully it won't be too boring. My hope is to just highlight some of the information we were able to glean from each of the questions. When we went into the school sites to obtain the height and weight data, we also asked parents to complete a simple 5-question survey regarding their nutrition and activity habits at home with their children, reflecting actually what their children were doing, their preschool children. The 5 questions included information about how much time their child spends in daycare, how much in terms of quantity, i.e. cups of sweetened beverages, their child drinks on a daily basis. We gave examples to hopefully clarify that question, including soda, fruit juice, sports drinks, etc. We also asked about how many trips their child takes to fast food establishments, again outlining some examples of what we were considering to be fast food, which also included things like the little mini marts and AM/PM services, as well as like the local food cart or burrito wagon that may be in the neighborhood or at different work establishments. We also asked about numbers of hours spent on a weekly basis in front of a screen. Keep in mind, we're talking about 3- and 4-year-olds when we get to this question in particular. And that includes television, computer, handheld games, etc. And then lastly, we asked about how many hours a week does your child actually participate in active play? So not really quantifying it as exercise, but just playing actively outside of their daycare environment, whatever that is. So we actually collected a total of 558 parent surveys, which was just a little bit less than the actual height and weight measurements we did of children. We measured 622 children. The surveys did not necessarily reflect each and every child that was weighed. So the surveys were kind of collected separately from the height and weight information that we had. And I think I just popped that up there, Jean. Did I do that? Wow, good for me. So what I really want you to get from that is that the actual survey information is not reflective of the actual children that were measured. They may be totally different children that the survey information was taken from. So this is the first slide. And the way that the slides are set up, just to give you an overview, the first slide for each question will always give you information regionally how parents responded. The second slide will be the same question, but it will give you a countywide overview. So this first question is reflecting numbers of hours that children are in daycare. We felt this was important information to garner from parents because we really wanted to know if there was a significant difference regionally in how children spend time in daycare or how much time they spend in daycare. And one of the caveats of this question is that we realized very quickly into the compiling of the answers is that parents did not interpret the word daycare to mean preschool. Preschool to them was something different, and we found that out through written responses on our questionnaire. So if we were to go back and do this again, we would definitely reclassify the terminology and actually ask for time spent in preschool. So what we believe happened is where we see that children listed at less than 15 hours a week would probably be less of a percentage. We would see our other percentages grow because we think these children actually were spending more time in outside schooling slash care than what was reflected here. So this is the overall response countywide, where you can see there's not really too much significant difference in the responses. They were all running about 30 to 35% response for each answers based on hours per week. The next question had to do with cups of soda, fruit juice, or flavored drinks consumed per day. And one thing I want to mention is we decided not to attach a particular volume to the word cup. We thought that would get way too complicated, and being able to try to glean that information from a parent responding on a written survey without us having physical examples we felt would be too cumbersome. So cups could be anything. It could be 3 ounces, it could be 4 ounces, it could be 8 ounces, it could be 12 ounces, for all we know. So looking at that, what we see is that we have a large majority of respondents who answered 1 to 2 cups a day. We had still a significant majority of respondents at about 20% for South County and for our North County, where they're having 3 cups a day. 3 and 4 year olds. That's a lot. We recommend nutritionally, as a nutritionist, less than 1 cup per day for children at that age, and a cup volume being 6 ounces. So we saw this as a potential area of concern, but also a potential area for education. What was very concerning was the respondents of 5 or more a day. So if we're thinking of a cup even at 6 ounces or 8 ounces, you're looking at a child who's drinking 32 to 40 ounces of sweetened beverage every day. So again, this is countywide. A majority of respondents at about 30%, 1 to 2 cups per day for each of those respondents. Yet at the 5 or more a day, we almost have 6-7%. Next slide. The next question relating to fast food. This is, how many times a week do you consume fast food with your child, or you take your child to fast food? And we found this to be very interesting because we thought, wow, most of our kids in our county go to fast food less than one time a week. That's great. And then we started thinking about it. Is that really true? We have a feeling what we actually were doing with many of these questions were surveying parents' knowledge, not necessarily practice or behavior. They know the right answer. They knew how to answer the question. They wanted to make sure that we knew they knew the right answer, but they weren't necessarily being truthful. Because as a parent, going to fast food less than one time a week in this day and age is almost unheard of. We suspect that that number is much higher. And here is the countywide results of that question. We had almost 55% countywide responding that they visit fast food less than one time a week. 1 to 2 times a week, just under 40%. And then 3 to 5 times a week, about 5% of our children. And there was one note that we had a respondent who actually answered that they visited fast food 10 times per week. So we think they were either A, being very honest, or B, didn't understand the question. We're not sure. This particular slide relates to the screen time. How many hours does your child spend per week sitting in front of a television, a computer, playing video games, holding handheld devices? The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends for children no more than 1 to 2 hours per day. Now keep in mind, these are 3 and 4 year olds, so I would be even hesitant as a parent and a medical professional to recommend 2 hours a day of screen time to these children. And what we're seeing again is that parents knew either the right response because they responded to less than 1 hour a day for their kids to watch cheap TV, or they're actually putting this to practice. We don't know. But a vast majority of our parents did answer that their children were spending about 1 to 2 hours per day on average watching television. And this is how it looks countywide. So we had a few that were over 2 hours per day. This particular question, I apologize for the slide, it's very confusing, but this question relates to how many hours per week does your child spend in physically active play or exercise, and we broke it up by region. And what's really positive about this answer is that we have a majority of our respondents regionally answering that their children are spending more than 10 hours a week, which would be a little more than an hour a day in active play, which is positive. But what I'm concerned about, if you note on the respondents of the 5 to 6 hours per week, that's still a pretty significant number of children who are literally spending less than an hour a day in active play. Now keep in mind, this is outside of their daycare or preschool environment. This is when they're at home. But it was inclusive of weekend time. So you would think on the weekends they would be playing a lot. And our concern is that that's possibly not the case. And this is how it looks countywide. Again, almost 30% of the respondents said, yes, my child's playing more than an hour a day in active play. But yet we had just under 20% saying, no, my child really isn't playing more than an hour a day. And if you look at the 0 to 2, 5% of the respondents said they're not playing at all. So what are they doing? Because they're not watching TV. So we're not sure. So it really does open the door for maybe looking at doing another survey. So that's the end of the questions in the parent survey. what we did as a committee is we looked at the overall responses, and we really did make a decision that we were probably actually surveying parent knowledge versus practice, which was great, because what it then did is it gave us a cue as to where we needed to proceed. And our next step was to actually develop a curriculum that could be shared in all the preschools that really incorporated nutrition and activity messages. And we are currently working on that. I have 3 Cal Poly senior project students who are actually writing the curriculum for their senior projects. They will be piloted in, the curriculum will be piloted in 4 sites. And we're going to then see if we're able to make a difference in parents' practices as well as hopefully their knowledge base, but really trying to provide them with the tools and behaviors they need to embrace what they know or what they seem to know as good nutrition and activity behaviors in their home. Any questions?
Are there any questions from the commissioners? Commissioner Warren?
Yes. Did you also look at the same information with the daycare center providers and the preschools themselves?
We did. We did a very brief survey with the daycare, or actually we would call them preschool sites, asking similar questions in terms of the behaviors. And really we got very standard responses that children are provided time for active play both in morning and afternoon sessions. They are, many of them, teaching nutrition in their curriculum. And really the difference being is what we're trying to do is provide them a curriculum where nutrition and activity is not considered a separate idea. That what we're trying to do is if you're teaching a concept to your children in the preschool environment, let's say you're teaching colors, that you can add nutrition and activity into that topic area and do it not really covertly, but so that it's not a separate message. So every message that's being delivered can have that kind of slant or feel to it. But the preschools seem to be doing a good job in terms of what they're offering for the kids. Most preschools don't offer nutrition on site, the exception being like our Head Start programs where they do have a meal program. So most food's actually being brought from home. And so we're trying to do more outreach with the parent groups associated with each of the preschools, trying to provide them with good information about how to pack a healthy, nutritious lunch and make it safe at the same time.
And I have another question about the difference between the daycare and preschools. So you're actually really only wanting to address preschools rather than the daycare situation, where I'm thinking some confusion for some of the parents. If they're working 2 jobs, like in many of the Hispanic families, and maybe a relative or someone else picks the children up for the remainder of the day.
You're exactly right. What we were initially trying to do is really try to garner the most bang for our buck. So we went to sites where we knew they were relatively large preschool / daycare sites, because we were looking to really try to get as many numbers as we could in terms of the height and weight data collection. So that was our focus. But what we're really hoping to do is once we get the curriculum intact and ready to be delivered, that it will be offered to licensed daycare providers as well, who also take care of this age group. Absolutely.
Are there any other questions from commissioners? Thank you very much for bringing us this information, and we'll look forward to the next chapter.
Coming up shortly. Thank you.
The next item on our agenda is a report from Amy Gilman on the Obesity Prevention Task Force. Welcome, Amy. We're glad to see you.
Well, thank you very much, and thank all of you. I'm quite pleased, actually, with your whole agenda. I liked how everything flowed. That was from my perspective, and I liked learning about the tobacco cessation program. So we're trying to explore ways of how we could be working with that program as well. As Chair Enns mentioned, my name is Amy Gilman, and I'm currently contracted with Derringer and Associates for this project to coordinate the Obesity Prevention Task Force. So I am supposed to update you on what we've been doing, and in fact, a lot has been going on, as you've been hearing earlier. I did want to give you some of the data once again, just because we have a new map, which is quite provocative, and it's always good to rehash the importance of this epidemic. This map we shared last year, and it starts in 1991. People didn't care enough, and they only slashed and dotted the map. And then increasingly, 10 years later, the map was filled in. And at that point, the dark blue represented 20% to 24%. And dark blue with hash mark was the highest category at the time, at greater than 25% of the adult population was obese, which is greater than 30% BMI. Now, the latest maps out of CDC is for 2005. And they've completely changed the color scale, one, to make it more legible, but certainly to add a whole new category of greater than 30% of the adult population being obese. As has been historically, the South has the greater problem, but California still, it's 20 to 24% are obese. Our slide, and for our county and what we're used to talking about in California, is that over 50% are overweight or obese. And so that change extends the categorization to be over 25, a BMI of 25. So this is greater than 25. Your health risk greatly increased from 25, but you don't get classified as obese until greater than 30 BMI. I'm going to put percent in there. As Susan mentioned, we're suffering the same problem with the data. We've been relying upon data coming from the California Health Interview Survey from UCLA. Data for 2005 will only be ready in January of next year. So we're still relying on 2003, and we're all eagerly waiting to see what those numbers will be. School-based data is more recent. They do the annual fitness gram. And this is slightly updated from what you've seen, but it still shows that males compared to females have a greater problem. In fifth grade, it's 35% of the males. It drops slightly by ninth grade. And by ethnicity, again, it's the Latino children that have the greater problem. Nearly twice as much Latino boys are overweight or obese compared to white children. And just to go back to Dana's data, we have approximately 30% of our children in preschool settings that are overweight or obese. So it cuts across all the age groups and certainly led the county to pursue a task force. And just to go back on some of the history, it was September of last year that we first came with a presentation from, at that time, a community collaborative group called Gold Coast Collaborative. That group now has a new name called Healthy Eating, Active Living, HEAL SLOW for short. And they've formed a voice for the county and first came seeking your recommendation to pursue a task force, which was then passed, well, approved by the Board of Supervisors, including the allocation of staff time to participate in the task force. And subsequently gave funding to actually staff the task force. That funding goes through the San Luis Obispo County Community Foundation. Did I get that right? Community Foundation. And they act as a convener for the task force. The funding came with the objectives of, one, convene the task force over a six-month period, resulting in a strategic action plan by end of March of next year. So we're on a short time frame and work quite quickly to get through all of the topics that need to be discussed. The outcomes I find actually most interesting because a lot of our results are part of the process is really what's going to get us through to an action plan, but also enable us to implement the action plan. One, we need to identify the organizations and the actions themselves that need to take place in order to avert the epidemic, reduce the childhood obesity. We also need to identify the policies that need to be changed or developed in order to make it happen. We need to identify the organizations that, in fact, will do that work, because nobody, the issues cut across various agencies and organizations, and no one individually or one agency is really tasked to do that. So we need to sort that out. Along with this, in order to make an action plan work, the leaders' awareness needs to be raised about the importance and what steps can be taken. And increased coordination between the various agencies and partners. And then, of course, as always, identify the funding sources. I quite liked how Mr. Jenny from Parks and Rec mentioned that they've gotten quite good about seeking grants, and that is how we will get through this, particularly with, what was it, 86 not passing, Proposition 86 not passing this time. We'll all be looking for money, so we definitely need our partners. So the Community Foundation is the convener. Back when we heard we had funding in June, they immediately put together a steering committee comprised of representatives from public health, county office of education, county planning, HEALSLO, again, that the collaborative group, Parks and Rec, Latino Outreach Council, and, of course, the Community Foundation itself. They also saw fit, of course, to hire Derringer and Associates, and invitations were sent out to what was intended to be a short list in order to make a very effective task force, but in the end, there were so many partners that were required, we ended up with 32 task force members, which is slightly larger than a really flexible working group, but it really was necessary. We had excellent response. It was basically 100% positive response of the letters we sent out. So at least at that level of key agencies and partner organizations, they were aware of the problem and eager to work on it. Parks and Recs, just so you know, we have one county parks participant and one and two city parks with us. We have a representative from the Health Commission. We do have a list of members. I didn't want to recite it, so I didn't bring it, but we have some excellent members. And again, we did have to set a tight meeting schedule. The intent originally was every 3 weeks hold a meeting. We've slightly juggled that already due to some other pressing meetings and holiday schedules. But we did convene the first meeting September 13th and followed with a series of what we call substantive meetings, six substantive meetings, where we tried to break down very broad areas of intervention, specifically food availability, also the availability of physical activity, which again is where Parks and Recs plays a key role. Then looking specifically at environments, we have home environment for family awareness and school environment where Dana's work has been coming in as well, as the school wellness policies that the schools themselves are implementing, and community environment, which is built environments. It also does touch on community collaboration, but more so we focus on how zoning and land use comes in. And then we're reserving one specifically for health and human services and how we can work to prevent but also treat obesity. And then the final two meetings will be on trying to finalize the recommendations and develop the strategic plan. So it's a lot of work in a short amount of time. But, the meetings so far have been very well attended and very energetic. For the most part, various persons from the task force have taken, say, ownership of their area of expertise. Food, we asked Carl Hansen from the San Luis Obispo County Food Bank to give the main presentation. Physical activity was kinesiology professor from Cal Poly. School was one of the Chris and Yard Elfers from County Office of Education. And each one brings in a panel of speakers to either back up or refute or tell another side of the story about what is it about our environment and the way we behave that, that contributes to our size. It's been very educational and well appreciated, I think, so far. We do, within each of these meetings, as I mentioned, we tried to break it down by subject area, but as we approach the recommendations, we try and look at it from the social ecological model or the onion, where if we start from an individual, what am I doing? What are my habits? What are my practices? But then my world around me impacts how I do and how I do things and why I do things, and so it reaches out to your interpersonal relations, your family, your friends, your coworkers, and how you get to your work and how you drop your kids to school. All of this has been created for you and goes through this layer of personal relationships with your environment as well. And then, of course, there's the policy that dictates how these are set up. So we try and break it down. Matrices. But I think it helps to clarify various issues that all of the agencies can work on. And then just to also give you a bit of an update on what is happening at the same time, because this isn't certainly taking place in a vacuum and we're not the only ones who are doing something. Each of the agencies and other people are doing activities at the same time. As Dana mentioned, maternal child care is developing a pilot program for the preschools, and hopefully that will reflect to the daycare centers. Jumping back up with the schools and the wellness policies, WIC is trying to change its food package based upon a federal mandate, but they're working on changing and improving the quality of their food packages. EOC Child Care is certainly on board. They're part of the collaborative. They're working on providing training to child care providers and other providers as well. And another one, which I skipped over quite quickly, was part of the original recommendations to the Board of Supervisors, was the exploration of the feasibility of a county staff worksite wellness program. And that's underway as well. So a lot is, and back to Parks and Rec as well, towards the bottom, not only are they pursuing plans for open space and recreation areas, they've also done, as a little side activity, maps of each city's walking trails, which hopefully will get distributed through providers as, say, a prescription to families that come to the medical providers. So there's very good activities, but again, back to the outcomes of the task force, this is where that task force serves as a forum to get all of the county activities together and well coordinated so that we can continue to work effectively towards better solutions. Last slide, come on, it's funny. So, luckily that's not in our county. Any questions?
Thank you, Amy, for a really nice overview of what this task force is doing. And the last slide, the mixed message, I mean, it says it all, doesn't it? Are there questions from the commissioners? Commissioner Donnelly.
My question really is that I would like to know, do you have some, are you going to be, or do you have a representative from the task force that's also going to be there to support the Parks and Rec plan tomorrow and give this frightening information to the Board of Supervisors?
Yes, Dr. Greg Thomas will be there.
Okay.
And Lance.
Okay.
But you're right. I kicked myself that, in fact, the task force or the collaborative group, Heal Slow, did not specifically write a letter or intend to be there is really a fault on our part. But, yes, Dr. Thomas will be there. Thank you.
Commissioner Warren? I see that it looks like you won't be really dealing with the social service issues until February. But has there been mention of Dr. Folletti's study through Kaiser Permanente on obesity and some of the... So that those things are brought in, and addiction, and all these kinds of areas I hope we're looking at, because, you know, I don't want to see us again kind of forget the treatment for people who have some real social and personal issues that they need to deal with.
That really is quite complex. It was raised, otherwise called the ACE study. It was raised in our first meeting, and I did share it with the members, but it hasn't come back as a broad issue yet. It probably won't again, you're right, until the last session on the medical, and that's, we have Child Services Network there. I'm suddenly spacing on her name. Lisa Frazier. Hopefully she can provide some more information on their perspective on what we can do.
Right. I hope that'll be followed up. And the bullying is a big piece within the schools and things, too. If we don't help address those other issues, you know, it's going to be difficult to get the results we want.
Are there any other questions from the commissioners or comments? Well, thank you very much, Amy, for hanging in there with us. And we certainly appreciate your being here and giving us this nice report. And we'll look forward to hearing from you again. All right, then. The next item on the agenda is the Public Health Department report. Dr. Thomas.
Okay, well, I suggest that while I'm giving my fairly short report, and you all have been sitting for 2 hours and 10 minutes, which is not healthy, that you take an activity break while I make my report, and then you can ask me questions when I'm done.
Okay,
so
we'll all
stand up while I talk. Good. Okay, so AIDS Update Symposium was last week and well attended. Dr. Gottlieb, who was the physician who identified the very first case of AIDS and reported it in the MMWR in 1981, was the primary speaker on 25 years of AIDS. And Dr. Bierman from Santa Barbara, clinician who has worked quite a bit with medical marijuana, also spoke, as well as Dr. Treisman from Johns Hopkins, who spoke on psychiatry and AIDS. And we had a doctors and pharmacists and practitioners evening presentation as well that kind of went into the medical management and pharmacologic management details a bit more. I wanted to report that the syringe exchange program has occurred over the last two Wednesdays. Utilization has been light so far, but that's as expected. Santa Maria took some time to get going, takes some time to develop trust with the folks who would be exchanging their syringes. Regarding budget development, our budget is due on February 9th. That's phase two, which is all the numbers. Phase one is results-based decision-making reports, and that's December, is due December 1st. We're working on that right now. So we'll really be working on our budgets in January, because we won't have received overhead projections or second quarter fiscal information, which we use as the full year projection until that time. So as the budget committee thinks about when it might want to meet, I want to take that into account. We submitted a planning grant for strengthening obesity prevention activities, particularly in public health. It's a planning grant for $30,000, so knock on wood, hopefully we'll get funded for that. And we did have a flu vaccine drill that I think I told you about last time. That's all for county employees. We vaccinated about 680 people in the first hour and a half, so it was quite a rapid drill, and we got then it slowed down until 4 o'clock, Everybody wanted to get there in line and get their flu shot first. So we learned a lot, and it was very good. And most people were quite satisfied with the wait. At the average was 18 minutes to get people through, although it was obviously a little bit longer in the first hour and a half and a little bit shorter during the later period of time. Somebody said it took 0 minutes to get through and get their flu shots, which I thought was very well done. Well, that's pretty quick. And somebody said it took 80 minutes, so we threw out the 0 minutes and 80 minutes, and the next highest was something like 32 minutes. So we figured there were two outliers there. And then in our senior clinic, we vaccinated 1,803, just very close to last year. But a lot more seniors say that they're successfully taking advantage of the much improved availability of flu vaccine in the community, and so they're getting it from their personal physicians, pharmacies, or other providers. EOC, Senior Health Screening, has been giving flu vaccine. So we still have flu vaccine, and they're still available at public health sites. Call for appointment. I also wanted to go over the ethics training handout. And let's see, here it is. I underlined the things that it's attached, and I wanted to emphasize which members must obtain ethics training. Members who are paid a stipend or other compensation, only other members are subject to ethics training requirement if they have received or expect to receive expense reimbursement from the county. And we have not to date. There is no payment for being on the Health Commission, and we haven't sent anybody off to any meetings. If you wish to come to the training, you can come on December 13th from 5 to 7 in the Board of Supervisors chambers. Ginger Fisher know, as it says in here on registration for the local lecture style trainings. Since you don't have to do it, if you take the test and then submit it to the Institute for Local Government with a processing fee of $50, you can do that, but since you don't have to do it, we won't reimburse you for it.
The people who attended the first two ones that were had here.
Beats me. I have no idea.
Yeah. It was in this room, I know.
It was in this room, and I signed up for the 13th. I'm sure they'll offer it again if it's oversold. If there's standing room only, either that or they'll make you sit in the other room down the hall and show you a video of it. Let's see. I think that's it. Any questions?
Thank you, Dr. Thomas. I think there are a lot of people that don't realize that the health commissioners are not paid, and we are not reimbursed for any of our expenses.
And you're not county employees.
And we're not county employees. Now we come to the health commission update. Oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner O'Dell.
And we are protected, though, by the county.
Yes, you are.
As far as liability and things.
Yes, you have the county council and county liability. And work and your volunteers, so that if you fall and break your leg on the way in, that's covered too.
Health Commission updates. I don't really have anything further to update. I've certainly said plenty tonight. Don't need to say anything more. I'll start at this end with Commissioner Garena. No update. Commissioner O'Dell.
No update.
Commissioner Warren.
And the Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board is busy looking at the starting the budget process and brought in two new members. And are preparing for a training with staff between the both mental health
and the drug and alcohol staff on co-occurring disorders, which they'll be having in December. Thank you. Commissioner Donnelly?
I attended the November Bioterrorism Task Force meeting, and one of the things that I had to report from there is a program called the Emergency Services Volunteer Health Professionals Program that nurses, doctors, emergency responders, pharmacists, and other healthcare professionals are encouraged to register at. Basically, what this is it's if you're in the medical profession, even if you're not working in a traditional medical setting right now, you can register at this site, and it's in the event of an emergency or disaster somewhere. You can register either to help on a local level, a state, or for national response. And we were given a website address that people can go to if you are one of these medical professionals and you want to volunteer to help to register. And that website is www.medicalvolunteer.ca.gov. That's it.
Thank you very much. I know when I was attending those meetings, they were working on putting that together, so that's really great. Commissioner Hetherington.
I will be attending my first Domestic Violence Task Force meeting on Wednesday. We've touched base, and we're good to go.
Commissioner Massey. All right, well, thank you. Now, the committee reports. I don't believe legislative, nominating, or budget have met. Am I correct?
No, we have not met. The legislative committee has not met, but our next meeting is scheduled for November 28th at 5:15 at the Public Health Small Conference Room.
And the Community Education Committee has met, and Commissioner Hetherington, would you like to give a report on that meeting?
Yes, we had a very interesting meeting. We would like to present to the Health Commission the idea of working with the Pharmacy Association, the Health Commission, maybe waste management, and I know that we will be looking for printing money to print out a flyer. Gene, I think you've got a copy of it. I think you've all seen it. Oh, Ed's got copies of it. In English and in Spanish about what to do with the drugs. So Gene's going to be calling me with an estimate from Repro about printing the double-sided color. And then we're going to look for some money. So there's interest on the part of the Surfrider local chapter and some of the pharmaceutical companies.
And anyone else who's listening to this, if you have an idea of where we might get money for printing this flyer, which really is important to all of us in terms of our environment. All right, then the last item on the agenda is the prospective future items, and we have our traditional meeting in December where we hear from nonprofit groups, and I imagine we have them all lined up, or we will, for our next meeting. And so we will suspend any other business other than hearing from the nonprofit groups. And Commissioner Warren, did you have something you'd like to say about future items?
Yes, I found an article that was in the Trib today, Viewpoint, speaking of emergency room physicians. It was written by Dr. Stephen Sainsbury on some of the things that he's seen through the emergency rooms with alcohol abuse. And I don't know at this point. I'd like everybody to have a chance to read it, and maybe at our next meeting we might come up with how we might bring this up at some future point as a topic.
Okay, so what you're saying is that you would like to see us address this popularization of funny drunks, basically, and there are a lot of other issues that support bad behavior that are out there. And there'll be a place. We'll find it out.
There'll be a place, and he does a good job of bringing out that it's not who we like to always think that it is, and that maybe we need to take a broader view.
The other thing that I wanted to mention was just looking at the upcoming meetings that we had talked about in January, having hospital issues and about the availability of beds, staff, the helipads, the shortage of doctors and nurses, and also something about what public health nurses do, so that we are aware and the public is aware what the services of the public health department are in terms of nursing. Also, there's a program that has been started called the Purple Band Program, and we will hear from that group as well. And that program is to identify elderly, if they end up in an emergency room, what they need and who they are, and so I think that you will find that interesting to learn about. Are there any other Commissioner Grana?
Ask a question about that. Does that include one of the things we're trying to do is to get medication lists to patients, sort of like the Vital of Life program? Do we have programs like that in this area where we ask people to keep their medication lists available for easy access when they're admitted or when an ambulance comes?
I know that Vial of Life program exists here in the county because I've encountered it as a home health nurse several times. How widespread it is, I really don't know. And I'm not aware of exactly what the Purple Band program is doing. That's why we're going to have Terry Whitcomb come and tell us about it. So are there any other questions or comments of items that you'd like to see in the future? Commissioner Hetherington.
I think we should plan on having the Regional Water Quality Control Board. Their test results, I think, should be ready from the FOUND program. I think that's what the fellow, Matt Thompson, said, whoever was here.
We were going to have them, and then we kind of moved them aside, didn't we, I think, last month. Water quality.
I mean, here the Bay just came out with an F for Pismo Beach, I think, yeah. We ought to be looking
that
at water
paper,
quality.
Yeah. Okay, well, possibly we can put that in our, you know, as a report in our January meeting. It doesn't sort of go with the theme, but...
Well, I don't think it needs to be in January.
Yeah. Oh,
I think we could push it out to February or March.
Okay.
And I think, too, an update from the Ag Commissioner. Weren't they working on some sort of language for GE crops and a notification program? I think that I would think that the Commission would still want to keep abreast of what was going on in the county.
We could certainly ask the Ag Commissioner to give us a report on that. As I recall, I believe that working group was going to come up with guidelines, and I don't know how frequently they've been meeting. I know nothing about what they've been doing.
Well, let's find out.
So, and I think we could find out. That would be no problem. Okay. All right, then. Is there anything else that commissioners wish to bring up? If not, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
Sure.
Assuming all are in favor, this meeting is adjourned.